Ruby. Good evening. Welcome to JTS to the next in what has been a very distinguished series of book talks this year, and I am particularly excited about our author and the book that we are going to discuss this evening. I do have to say, before I actually formally begin, either a lot of people are showing up late, or a lot of people signed up who decided that they were so exhausted by the State of the Union that they just couldn't get out of the, of their homes tonight. But be that as it may, we are recording this, and it will appear on our website for many, many others to hear. I'm thrilled about that as well. My name is David Kramer. I am the director of the library here at JTS, and I have the privilege of ordinarily just kind of doing introductions and welcoming you, as I just have. This evening, I have the privilege of engaging in a conversation, interviewing, as it were, our author. Because when I approached him and asked him if he would do this, he said, okay, you ask me questions. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to. So that's going to explain the format of what we're doing. I have to begin, before we begin our conversation, by saying that, kind of being open, full disclosure. The full disclosure here is that I've been a fan of Ruby's for a very, very long time. That fandom originates, actually, I've never told you this, but it originates in the fact that he and I are members of the same synagogue group, and generally, I mean, it's a lay-led group, and generally when someone gets up to offer some wisdom relating to that week's Torah portion, I find myself struggling. You can fill in the rest of the sentence. But when Ruby gets up, there is literally not a time when I don't find myself excited and stimulated by insight, and the insight is generally on the edge or over the edge of brilliance. When someone can kind of lift you up that way, then you're going to be a fan. And that is what made me a fan a long time ago. I had the privilege of being able to read this book, The Ruined House, first in its Hebrew version, and then eagerly looked forward to the English translation, wondering all along and having discussions with Ruby how that translation would work, what it would gain, what it would lose, and we'll say something about that this evening. I'm just curious, those of you who are here, raise your hand if you've read the book already. No, great. So in order to be able to discuss this, we're going to begin by my simply asking you to let everybody in on the secret. What's the book about?
Okay. Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. And thank you, David. This is very, it's great to be here. The novel is, my wife always makes a point. She says, make sure you tell them the plot. It's very important. So the novel, The Ruined House, describes a year in the life of Professor Andrew Cohen, who lives in this neighborhood, and he is a very successful, elegant, fashionable person who manages his life very well. You know, everything is where he wants it to be. He does a peak of his career. He publishes in all the right places. He has a wonderful relationship with his ex-wife and daughters and his young girlfriend. And he's really a cliche of the New York success story, as we know it. And to top it all off, he lives alone in a marvelous apartment with full river view, and we all know what that means for a New Yorker, right? Our true envy is always real estate envy. So he inhabits alone a marvelous piece of real estate. And this novel follows a year in the life of Professor Cohen, in which his mind, his life, all the structures of his life and mind are beginning to unravel. And as this happens, And there's more friction and more friction in this seemingly perfect life that he leads. He also begins to see visions. Visions from the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. And he has no tools, emotional or intellectual, to decipher, to understand, to place these visions or make any meaning of them. And they continue to become stronger and more vivid, almost threatening to swallow him in. Now, there's a second plot, there's a subplot in the book that I'm sure we'll talk about, that is arranged and told, told and arranged on the page, not as a modern literary text, but rather as a Talmudic tale. And in this plot is a completely different story, or is it? It describes a drama happening between two priests in Jerusalem, in the Second Temple, on the Day of Atonement, which was the peak of the Avodah, the peak of the cultic work of the temple. And those who will brave these pages may gain some extra insight about what is ailing our friend Andrew Cohen.
Okay, great. So that at least provides us with a foundation. Let me, you and I briefly discussed this as yeah. we were sitting on the side, but I mean, from a description as brief as the one you just offered, it's hard to really capture much of this book. But I thought actually from a description even briefer, that is to say, the last paragraph of the review, which was published just a couple of weeks ago, January 14th, in the Sunday book review in the New York Times, Josh Lambert finishes his review with what I personally thought was rather a brilliant insight. The way he described the book, you may be comfortable with it, maybe not, but let me just share it for those of you who may not have caught it or don't remember it. He completes the review by saying, "Namdar has no thesis, and the novel does not suggest that the return of the repressed would be easy or even productive. At times dripping in gore and effluvia, steeped in sacred texts and apocalyptic visions, the ruined house cannot be recommended lightly." Cannot be recommended lightly. "But it is a masterpiece of modern religious literature, exactly as deep, disturbing, and unresolved as is necessary to remind us, habituated as we are to the shallows of contemporary Jewish life, what still lurks beneath, primitive, raw, and exciting." I couldn't think of a better way to capture this book, but I'm curious what you think of this.
Well, first of all, do you notice his sentence structure?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's beautiful writing.
It is.
Needless to say that I'm ecstatic by this review, and it's been a very moving to feel so understood, and so a text for my text to be so understood and respected by such a smart reviewer, and also it has been extremely helpful. You know, I mean, this is not to be taken lightly, and I don't think, being Israeli, I don't think I quite understood the power of the New York Times. I thought it's like the English version of Haaretz, so it's not exactly. Just so it was a wonderful moment and incredible to read this. As I told you in our conversation before, maybe again because of my Israeli roots, the word religious, even though you know well that I am very traditional, I'm very comfortable with being part of the Jewish religion, I go to shul, the word religious literature made me a little, you know, I wouldn't say uncomfortable, but I noticed it. I felt the friction, if we go back to the idea of friction. Maybe because it is still hard for me to to think of Jewishness as a religion, and my relationship with it is a more complex entity. Having said that, I think he makes a very good case for it being a modern religious, and the modern year is very important.
Yeah, good. It's interesting. You said it's when you describe the plot that it's a year in the life of Andrew Cohen.
Yes.
It is a year in the life, but that actually misses a very important nuance of the way the novel is chronologically located. It actually works by two calendars. It's a crucial part of the book. One is what today is essentially the universal calendar, right? Yes. September, October, November. And one is the Jewish calendar. And every single event is correlated with both of those dates. And they turn out to be extremely important.
Very important.
So I'll come back to the use of the Jewish calendar a little bit later on. But just so that everyone understands, the first date where, when we enter this novel is September 6th, 2000. Right? So if this is going to cover a year, more or less, and it happens to be a little bit more, we know what's going to be part of this year. The last date is September 18th, 2001, which happens to correlate, to correspond with Rosh Hashanah.
Yes.
So that's for everybody. Bear that in mind. I'll come back to the calendar, but as religious work, that overlap, is it religious? Is it secular? Is even expressed in that duality in the book. Now, one of the dualities, which is actually not in the book as anyone will read it, whether they read it in Hebrew or English, is the duality of language, Hebrew, English.
Yes.
Right? In other words, anyone here is either going to read it in Hebrew or in English, or you might read it in both, but you're not going to read it in both at the same time. And obviously, these languages have very different history, very different resonance. One of the things that you and I discussed was how difficult it would be. This is a very, very thick and challenging Hebrew, and I read Hebrew novels all the time, but this was a different kind of read. I was actually quite relieved to find that when I read it in English, it was equally as thick and challenging,
nice.
Because it's in the writing, it's not in, that's what it's about. But having said that, there are obviously resonances for Hebrew that you can't quite capture in English, and that's going to be missed. That's on the one hand, right? So as I anticipated the English, I said, what's going to be missing in the English version? And again, you and I discussed that over and over again. But then I read the English. And as you said a moment, this entire novel, except for the high priest in the ancient temple, right, takes place in this neighborhood and in the neighborhood of NYU. And when you read this novel, you will discover that you will never again be able to walk past the corner of Broadway and 110th Street and feel the same way that you did before. It changes your perspective on everything, because I always see Andrew Cohen at the corner. Right? But having said that, something very interesting happened, and this is where I'd like to kind of challenge you. The whole thing takes place in an English-speaking setting.
Yes.
Right? That's the natural world. And so when I read the English, I said, now it's speaking in the language it should be speaking.
Yeah.
And the Hebrew is kind of a foreign window on everything described in it. So tell me if I'm right or wrong. Tell me what your reflection on that is. It's a very crucial element.
As always, you're right, and very right at that. And the language in this novel, much like the time that you are almost, they're almost protagonists. It was written in Israel that the Hebrew is one of the protagonists in the novel. Something similar was said about New York, that it's almost one of the characters. So the Hebrew version, the Hebrew edition, really had this kind of unnatural, but I think exciting, again, friction. This tension between the fact that it's a very New York and very now kind of book. It is not archaic at all. It's archaic as much as 2000 is past for us, less cell phones, but that's it basically. When the book was published in Israel, there was conversation about how can you tell an American story in Hebrew? And the Hebrew in the original version is a very Hebrew. It is not Americanized. It's not light or poppy or spoken. It is a very literary Hebrew that draws on Midrashic Hebrew and Talmudic Hebrew and Mishnaic Hebrew and Biblical Hebrew. And, you know, you're uniquely positioned to actually see this intricacy more than many of the Israeli readers who have less of a command of the different historic layers of the Hebrew. So yes, it was a kind of a subversive act almost to write such a non-Israeli book in such a Hebrew. And in that sense, bringing it back to English, in that sense, maybe was bringing it home, exactly as you are describing. Now, I want to say something about the point about being afraid to miss what do we drop in the translation, what do we give, what do we hold on to, and what do we let go of. So there was a lot of drama around the translation of this book. It was translated twice. There was another translation that was good enough, but not good enough. It was okay, but not good enough to really convey what this book has to offer and say. And there was a pretty daring and bold decision to taken by myself and the publisher to commission a new translation by the great Hillel Halkin, who is every bit as amazing and interesting to work with as his reputation. And it was a long courtship, and one day I should write a novella about the, because that in itself is going to be, he's worthy of a film, really. A wonderful, amazing man, a true master. So once we managed to hook up together and become a team, and we had a wonderful experience working on this book together, there was a conversation about what do we hold on to without being clingy, without, you know, becoming obsessed, and what do we let go of in order to allow this to be an English-American book. Because I did not want a Hebrew book that is written in English, because I wrote the Hebrew book already. That we did that. I really wanted, and Hillel thankfully went with it, that this book is not going to feel over-translated, stilted, artificial. It was very important to me. And yes, in the Hebrew, when you say a certain word, you hear the Hebrew Bible. In English, fewer words resonate the Hebrew Bible. They may resonate other canons. And yes, sometimes there was a decision to just let go of this allusion or that in order to, let's say, respect the autonomy of the English text and not to make it a shadow of the Hebrew. I'm very happy to hear that you think it was successful. I am too close with the text to be able to judge, yeah. You know?
No, I thought that, I mean, the translation's magnificent, I think, but so magnificent that it leads me to a part B of this question, which is, who is the author of the volume that I hold in my hand here?
Ooh.
Is it Ruby Namdar or is it Hillel Halkin?
That is a very, very good question that I think we should leave unanswered, right? Like, the best questions are unanswered. It is definitely not a simple answer, and I'm so happy that it's him, because, you know, with him, I'm happy to say he kind of gets a ton of credit.
Okay, good, that's great. I have to say, on the experience of reading it in Hebrew, I remember, the vocabulary is extremely rich. There were words I had to look up, which, that's not always the case when I'm reading Hebrew novel, but here I did. But the hardest phrase that I had, I remember when I arrived at it on the page, it was describing a place somewhere along Broadway, and the Hebrew was something like Dalet, Vav, Vav, Yud, Yud, Nun, and then the second word was Resh Yud Yud Dalet. I'm inventing this, but it was something like that. And I'm looking, I'm trying to figure out, what is this, right? And the answer is? Dwayne Reed, exactly. That was the hardest part. So, I mean, one of the things, if you know about this book at all, one of the things that you probably know is that it generated some controversy in Israel. It was sufficiently subversive, that it wrote in this magnificent Hebrew a story that was thoroughly about the life of a Jew and Jewish life. Primarily on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, New York City, in the years that we described. And so while it was winner of the Sapir Prize, immediately after it was awarded that prize, the rules for the prize changed such that an author, in order to be awarded the prize, needed to live in Israel. Is that right?
Yes.
Is that the way it was changed?
Yes.
So, I mean, you probably know about that. But I have a suspicion, and I want to share this suspicion with you about what was at least partially going on in the reaction. Okay? At more or less the same time as there was the reaction to your book in this way, there was another reaction to a book by an author who was living in Israel by the name of Dorit Rabinyan, right? Geder Chaya, right? The book which was translated, I think it has the name All the Rivers in its English translation.
Yeah.
And it is a story about a young Israeli woman and her relationship with a Palestinian man, primarily in New York City, right? And what struck me again was New York City was an important part of the story. And there they have a loving relationship in New York City.
Yes.
And then when they go back to Israel, they can no longer sustain that relationship. And so I wonder whether below the surface, even of the reaction to your book, is the danger, the threat, that there is a genuine and in some ways better Jewish life in New York City than there is in Israel.
I think so, and it may be a conscious, semi-conscious, or unconscious threat, but I think it is a threat. And my editor, Dr. Chaim Weiss, the Hebrew editor from Ben-Gurion University, wrote about it and said, people don't understand the level of subversion, because New York becomes not just a place of life and death, but it becomes a place of epiphany of the Jewish kind. The book opens by a description of the heavens opening above the great city of New York, and a ladder is revealed and angels. So there's a place of epiphany that we know, of course, from Jacob's ladder. But lo and behold, it happens above the West 4th Street subway station, right? in the NYU area. So by itself, you know, there's something about the Hebrew, and it's something that I always feel important to emphasize. Hebrew is not just a language, modern Hebrew. Modern Hebrew is also an ideology. It is in itself an ideology. I'm a believer in this ideology. I'm committed to this agenda. But Hebrew has a direction. The direction of Hebrew, if you will, is go east, young man. I mean, because it was forged in East Europe and Israel was conceived east, even though many of us came west to go to Israel.
Jews were never good with geography.
Yeah. And even from Poland and Russia, it wasn't Mizrach, it was more Darom, it was more south, but who's counting? But the idea was that Hebrew has a direction. It goes back in time and it goes eastward towards the origin of the language, or the imagined origin of the language. Now, to take this kind of Hebrew and to insist on deep Hebrew and take it west, okay, go west, reader, is a very, you're right, threatening thing. To make New York a place of Jewish epiphany is a threatening thing. To make to the little Israel that there is in the novel is not necessarily the most, you know, loving and luscious experience. That is threatening to Israelis. And to end the novel without anyone making aliyah and running back to Israel is also threatening to a Hebrew novel. Because in Dorit's book, All the Rivers, they do return to Israel,
right,
and everything collapses, but they do return. And here, nobody wants to use the right of return. So yes, I think you're absolutely right. It is threatening. and it undoes, if you will, it undoes the fabric and undoes the direction of Hebrew, and that's why it caused this kind of emotion. Yeah.
So you mentioned the apparitions, which are throughout, right, the novel, and become, I think it's fair to say, well, there's some very powerful visions early on. They become more frequent and more disturbing as the novel goes on. Do you read from the English version as author? I mean, we often have readings. Is there any section of this that you would feel comfortable reading?
Or? I usually like to read the beginning. Mm-hmm. And you know something funny?
Yeah.
I'm very comfortable speaking in English. When I read from my own book, uh-huh. I feel like an immigrant. I'm like, okay, I can't read so well, but I will anyway.
Yeah, I mean, if you want, would you do just a little bit?
Of course,
I think people deserve to hear the line. So what do you like, the very beginning?
I like the beginning, if that's okay.
Okay,
I think
sure,
the beginning
sure.
is...
Go ahead.
If I were more chutzpahdik, I would ask you to read it, but I'm not.
Well, I can do that too, but you go ahead.
I'll do it. Yeah, I think the beginning is a good place to begin, right?
Mm-hmm.
Look at Genesis, how well it works. One clear morning, on the sixth day of the Hebrew month of Elul, the year 5760, counting from the creation of the world, which happens to fall on Wednesday, September 6th, 2000, the gates of heaven were opened above the great city of New York, and behold, all seven celestial spheres were revealed, right above the West 4th Street subway station, layered one on top of another, like the rungs of a ladder reaching skyward from the earth. Errant souls flitted there like shadows, one alone, bright to the point of transparency, the figure of an ancient priest, his head wrapped in a linen turban and a golden firepan in his hand. No human eye beheld this, nor did anyone grasp the enormity of the moment, a time of grace in which not a prayer would have gone unanswered. No one but an old homeless man who lay on the bench, filthy and bloated with hunger, shrouded in his tatters, wishing himself dead. He passed instantly, without pain. A blissful smile lingered on his face, the smile of a reprobate, his penance completed, granted eternal rest.
No, I'm going to read some as well, actually, but I'm going to use it for a question.
Okay.
As a vegetarian, I don't have a lot of patience for the celebration of meat. There is no one I know who enjoys and understands meat better than you do. Right, I mean, Ruby is actually famous for his celebration of flesh. I'm going to share a little bit about meat and then
Wonderful.
Ask you, okay? The one thing I have to say about this is that if you were reading this from the page, and often what's on the page is very important, you would see that some part of it is in italics and the other part is in regular, square print. And that's very crucial, actually, for what's happening. So this is vision, this is dream,
yes.
And it's a lot of meat. The cubed lamb sizzled on the hot, brassy surface of the skillet, crisping at the edges and turning an appetizing amber. He and his father had been so unlike each other, so different. The meat was beginning to smoke thickly. It was time to turn it before it blackened and grew bitter. Deftly, Andrew flipped the chunks of lamb in the pan. They were almost ready to be taken out and to make way for the carrots. Every ingredient in the way it's prepared is crucial here.
Yes.
Right? More images drifted through his mind, borne on the savor of the meat like puffs of cloud on a spring breeze. Escaping the confines of the New Rochelle yard, they changed texture and hue, taking him to a vast sandy sea of yellows and grays. Large, crudely cut gemstones were embedded in a heavy breastplate of burnished gold, glowing in the desert sun like small, mysterious-looking celestial orbs. Where was this place? Where was all this light coming from? The meat was done. Andrew, rudely awakened from his daydream, quickly transferred the brown pieces to a platter waiting by the stove. The golden bells rang with a gentle, tranquilizing chime, a sound clearer and purer than any he had ever heard. The meat, still faintly sizzling, lay piled on its platter. Now the carrots crackled in the skillet, frizzing in the hot oil while soaking up the meat's flavor and scent. The tinkle of bells heralded the arrival of the priest in the sanctuary, alerting God and man to his presence. Golden bells, pomegranate-shaped orbs of purple and scarlet. A golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate. Right, some of you can translate that back to biblical Hebrew. Under the hem of the robe, round about, a sweet scent wafted in his nostrils, inducing a dreamy wakefulness. Thin cakes of meal anointed with oil, a bullock, and two rams. Where are we? Right, in New York, in Jerusalem, in the early 21st century, in the first century of the Common Era. Color, smell, sizzle, sound. I mean, it's just absolutely extraordinary.
Thank you.
Help us make sense of it.
First of all, I have to say, hearing you read, I am amazed by Hillel Halkins. It's amazing.
Yes.
Wow. We are in a vision, and the visions here are woven into the mind and experience of our protagonist, and therefore the readers, in a way that comes in and out, very elusive, present, but you can't pin it down and say, okay, that was a vision. And the same thing that happens to Andrew, I believe, happens to the reader, because you're thrown off guard a little bit. You don't really know where your everyday consciousness begins and where that other consciousness begins, and what the boundaries are. And as the book proceeds, the boundaries become more and more blurred. And this is perhaps one of the messages of the book, is that challenging these boundaries. Now, a word about meat. Meat in this book is a very important symbol. Not just because I'm a fresher and I also really love to cook and serve meat, but also because meat is not just a food. You know, you can have a burger for lunch, that's not so. Meat is also a symbol, and it's a very loaded symbol. And for us, the Jews, it actually is a symbol that connects us to our ancient cultural roots. Because our original form, the original form of worship, one of the major ones, in ancient Israel, was the preparation, sacrifice, and eating of meat, which we, to the day, replace with the relatively, I have to say, meager substitute of words when we daven. You know, daven, have a steak. Let's see. You know? Meat is also...
You know, it'd be actually, shuls would be a lot more successful if they served barbecue and... Right, man.
And you know what was happening in the incense. It's a full sensory in my... But one thing about meat that is important, there's meat in the Bible itself and in the rabbinic literature, as you know well, is always a source of ta'ava, of passion, and also a source of danger. Whenever the Israelites sat to eat meat, something bad happened. It releases, right? The eating of meat, the craving of meat, releases also powers inside and outside of humanity that are dangerous. The Kabbalah, we have here an expert on Kabbalah, the Professor Eitan Fishbein. I mean, in Kabbalistic thought, meat is associated with gvura, and the eating of it is a dangerous thing that one should, at least in some strands of Kabbalah, one should either refrain from or do very cautiously and mindfully, because it's... And also we see towards the end of the book that this passion for meat also can, it turns So it's a place, the craving of meat has a, it's a place of danger and almost a touch of death in this vitality that it brings.
Yeah. And the most expensive cut of meat in the novel actually accompanies in its decline, a certain decline on Andrew's part,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It becomes, we're not going to give it away, but it becomes a very, I think, potent symbol.
I didn't know that meat could cost that much. Anyhow, one of the things that I'm sure you've been asked about a lot, and as a Talmudist I can't not ask you about, is the pages that look like this, if you can see them. And they're easy to pick out in the book because they're printed on grayish pages as opposed to white.
Yes.
Right? And they appear throughout the sections of the book. At the center of the page, printed, you know, as we know, the Talmudic page is laid out. At the center is the story that you described before of the two priests, the Yom Kippur service, you know, in the Second Temple. And around it is what is offered as a commentary. But when you look at it carefully, what you find is that not all, but most of the texts that are in the columns of commentary are Talmudic texts. Actual, straightforward, right, unadulterated Talmudic texts, which this is the Talmud's engagement of and description of the service in the temple of the priests, right, way back when. And so I look at this and I say, wow, I didn't even appreciate this in the Hebrew, I admit, right?
It was not as good in the Hebrew as it is in English.
There's something amazing, but it's subversive in the same way as the others. All of a sudden, the text, which traditionally is at the center and on which the commentators commentate, right? I don't know if that's a word, but you get what I mean.
It is now.
Becomes itself a commentary on a modern story.
Yes. And this is, again, as you say, it's subversive and it's taking the equation, it's flipping it on its head, but it's aspiring to look at it. So it's at the same time an homage, of course, to the Talmudic page and to the Vilna Shas, you know, to the classic arrangement, which I find to be very alluring visually and aesthetically, and a masterpiece of the work of print, which we don't often think about the Talmud as a wonderfully aesthetic experience, but it is. Each one of these pages is a masterpiece, and yes, I feel that. That this is an homage to the graphic designers of the Talmud and to the thinkers of the Talmud. At the same time, yes, I take a modern Jewish story, I place it in the middle, and I use the classic text as a commentary to it, and I find this very exciting to be able to do that. You know, it's a one more thing about these pages, if I may,
please,
is that I want to say that they are as almost, perhaps even as or more challenging to the average Israeli reader as they may be for the American reader. So it is not to be thought that, oh, in Israel, everybody knows what to do with this page. Everybody knows what it's not at all the case. My readers from the religious groups, which were many and were very interested in this book, could understand what's going on. But anyone who grew up in the secular, such as myself, secular Israeli school system, is not well versed in the Talmud and doesn't know the mechanics of the Talmudic page. So it was as much of a challenge for an average Israeli reader to know what to do with this page as it is for the American reader. And my assumption is that many readers are going to skip it in the beginning. They're going to say, okay, I can't deal with this. Let's see what happened next. It's fine. Many will skip it, read until the end, enjoy the book, I hope, and get a lot out of it. And I hope that some of those who skipped are then going to come back and try again and see what they can get from these pages. And for everyone, including those who skip the pages, I think that the pages also, just the appearance of them, is a message in its own. Because they suggest an extra layer to this story, which connects this story to a past story. And it just suggests that there's more to the story than meets the eye. So, of course, best thing is to study these pages, but we made sure that the main plot is coherent, even if you don't manage to read these pages.
No, and it definitely is. I mean, you can literally skip them, but you'll miss something, right? But each is independent of the other as well.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to make sure and leave some time for those who are here to ask some questions. But I have a couple of final related questions. I'll ask them one and then the other, but again, they're related. And before I say this, I just want to say that as the review in the Times says, this is not a book that is about, you know, what happens at the end, a plot that works out. I hope you agree with that.
Yes.
Yeah? The reason I say that is, it's the process, kind of like the Talmud, right?
Yes.
It's not where you get to, but it's how you get there.
Absolutely.
Right. So in light of that fact, I think it's fair to me to ask about the end of the book without fear that I'm going to be undermining your experience of it, those of you who will purchase it shortly and read it. The calendar at the end of the book... takes place between, I don't know what the English dates are until the last date, but between the 17th of Tammuz and the 9th of Av.
Yes.
Right? So this book about the ruined house ends with the period of the Jewish calendar, which of course is precisely about the ruin of the house.
Yes.
Right? The Bayit, Chorban HaBayit. Andrew, during that period, and particularly on the 9th of Av, experiences some of the most frightful visions we can imagine, and those visions are actually within him.
Yes.
Right? Could you expand about on that in ways that you're comfortable, that you think will enhance and not undermine their experience?
Yes. The book, as like all those rivers, all the rivers of the book flow towards these 3 weeks, which of course we call them Ben HaMetzarim, the besieged. And it's, the siege is internal as well as external. Andrew, as a carrier of this ancient memory that erupted in his life and have taken possession of his world for a year, is driven to almost madness and almost mental collapse because that the individual mind cannot hold all this vastness of history and the religious and cultural gravity of that he's carrying. And for me also it was important that his personal wrongs that he never remedied and the historic will converge in this time. So that it is for me at the same time a personal tale of I don't want to say crime and punishment, but like wrongdoing and the need to mend, and at the same time also cultural and historical one. And Tisha B'Av is where everything converges. This is the moment. Absolutely.
Then in the epilogue, as I said before, takes place on September 18th, 2001. For those of us who were, you know, in New York City on that date, that wasn't just another Rosh Hashanah.
No.
It was a radically different Rosh Hashanah than any we had ever experienced. In our minyan, actually, the Shabbat in between September 11th and Rosh Hashanah that year, we had a bat mitzvah, right? Were you there? Do you remember? Fishman.
The
family from out of town coming from Israel couldn't arrive for this bat mitzvah because the planes were not yet coming back into town. So it was a shocking time. Yet Andrew, on that first day of Tishrei in 2001, walks out of his apartment at 110th Street and Riverside Drive, and runs into neighbors who are headed to do tashlich.
Yes,
right at the Hudson River. Those of you who live in this neighborhood will know that this is probably the largest Jewish event on the Upper West Side, right, in any given year. Right? It's a wonderful occasion. But, you know, the hint here, and it's the beginning of your epilogue as well, suddenly everything seemed back to normal.
Yes.
Right? Which is an interesting claim, although at the end of the epilogue, things may change a little bit, right? But there's something redemptive about this Tashlich. So how do we understand that? That's so quick a redemption.
You know, I think that there is a certain... I was reproached, by the way, for this happy end by certain people. And it's legitimate reproach. That there's something Hollywood-y about it at the end. And I say, yes. I mean, being an American story, it plays with Hollywood cliches, and it worked within the frame. Andrew's caricaturistic life in the beginning of the book, I almost said the film, is Hollywood. And then the end kind of recaptures it, but with a twist. It's a barbed happy end. At the same time, I feel that there was the act of tikkun that Andrew needed happens on the time between Tisha B'Av and Rosh Hashanah. This is a time where we don't learn a lot about, but it is suggested that during this time, some budding of tikkun have begun. And you know, we belong in a tradition that is optimistic about the ability to mend. We're not tragic in the way that we say it's finished. Sharei Tshuva Einam Ninalim. We know that Sharei Tshuva Einam Ninalim. The gates of repentance are not locked. And therefore, I feel I live in peace with this ending. And I feel that it actually works with this frame.
Okay, good. Well, there's a lot more to say, but I want to make sure that you have some time. So please, yes, sir. And I'm going to repeat each question so that we have it recorded. Go ahead.
Being an Israeli myself, an American as well, it's very hard to club all the American Jewish community in one and all the Israeli Jewish community as another. But the gap is vast. Was there any attempt in this book to bridge the gap and explain to the Israeli community about the American Jewish society and vice versa?
You want to repeat this?
Yes. Do you try to bridge the gap between the American Israeli Jewish communities, at least offer some understanding that each may gain of the other? Do I have it right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I have a dual answer. In my private life as a speaker, as a public speaker, I do a lot of that, actually. I speak to Israelis who live in here. I write and speak about American Jewry in Israel. I speak about the complex and very interesting relationship between these two communities. As an author, I don't feel that my job is to serve a social agenda. And I even would say that had I done that, I think I would have doomed my work to be a mediocre. I feel that the place of art and fiction in our world is not to bridge and explain. It actually is to dig into the wounds, open things, leave things raw in a way. So actually, I would say that when you read this, you may see that actually I may be even opening a little wounds that usually people don't speak about the relationship between the two, and I leave them open. For me, the power of art is not in the explanations that it provides, but it's in the unanswered questions. So this is a very honest, and I thank you for this question.
Dalarcha. Yes.
First of all, I'm about 40% of the way through the book, and I'm enjoying it tremendously. So
wonderful, thank you.
What strikes me, every time I read this, I'm amazed as I'm reading it, that it was written by an Israeli, somebody that didn't grow up in America. Because while I realize you live here now, you didn't grow up here, but Andrew Cohn did, and grew up in Westchester, lives in the Upper West Side, and it just resonates, it's so authentic, from an American who has a somewhat similar background to him. And Was that a challenge for you? How did you go about that?
Mm-hmm. So how did someone who did not grow up in the setting that Andrew grew up in manage to represent someone who is so thoroughly in, you know, naturally inside himself as an American Jew, having grown up with that whole, you know, cultural milieu?
American secular Jew, Israeli secular Jew.
Thank you for this question. This novel was written in under very unusual mental and emotional circumstances. I came to New York exactly 18 years ago. For a very personal and wonderful reason, I was fell in love with a local. It was a long, old story, love story that it was rekindled. And, you know, now we are very happy and going to Minyan Me'at and raising our daughters in Shul together. And we, when I first came to New York, I was very, you know, in a state of elation, you know, under this wonderful glow of this wonderful love affair. And walking the streets of New York in a kind of a free, open, very exposed way. And I think that lent my mind at that time a certain hypersensitivity, a certain exposedness. That maybe since then, I hope not, but it could, maybe since then I grew a skin and I would experience it in a less raw and intense way as I did then. So the first 2 years of my stay here were really a laboratory where I took it all in, and it was a very, again, it was a time of betwixt and between. I was enough of an insider to understand things, but enough of an outsider for them to amaze and stimulate me. So I think that this was a window that enabled me to be insider and outsider at the same time. I am curious, if I write more American books, how are they going to look? It is a question that is I'm also curious about. But thank you for that, because it's good to hear that it actually resonates, your experience.
It resonates, it's true.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, thank you.
Yes?
How was the last chapters of the book about that period of time between Tisha B'Av and Rosh Hashanah, where we had such a calamity happen in New York? Unfortunately, these kind of calamities have happened many times in Israel.
Yes.
So how was that responded to in Israel?
So the question is about the, I mean, 9/11 being the focus at the end of the book, and the fact that in Israel there have been many terrorist attacks. So how is this focus on, you know, the American New York experience received in Israel?
Great question. Thank you. I like to refer to 9/11 here as a focal point of the novel that's outside of the frame, because it is not directly discussed. It's mentioned, it's there, it hovers. I think readers would see that where this novel is taking them. But it is not really, what actually happened in the World Trade Center is not in the novel the way it is in other novels that were written about it. It's there, but it's not, it's outside of the frame. Israelis are very interested in New York. The whole world is very interested in New York. New York is a fetishized city. There's something about our life here that is fetishized, glamorized, draws a lot of attention. It feels like it's a symbolic gravity center of the world. So September 11 didn't happen just to us New Yorkers. I think the whole Western world and the whole world felt it in different ways. It felt personal, and people were very curious about it. In general, the Israeli reader was very, very curious about New York and about the specific, pretty mythologized New York of this novel. So this actually was a strong attraction for the Israeli reader.
Yes?
Yeah, I'm curious about your writing process, especially around the visions that occur throughout the book, which I haven't read yet. Did you plan
very carefully where the visions were going to come?
Yes.
Or did they sort of happen as you were writing them, or was it a combination? Were you surprised sometimes to find yourself all of a sudden writing the vision?
No.
So, I mean, the question's about the writing process, and particularly about the visions, where they appear, were they planned in advance, right? How did that work?
Look, there are two poles to creative writing. Some authors need and like and want to surprise themselves with every page. I am the exactly other side. I am a very deliberate writer, and I have the whole gesture, including the tone, the narrating voice, sentence structure. It kind of falls as a whole. And when I manage to capture it, the rest is trying to work and to keep it together. So relatively, I am from the very tight, deliberate school of writing. And these visions were very carefully planned and planted. I did surprise myself here and there. When you write, you open a door and stuff comes that surprises you. You didn't know it was dormant there. But it's all within the structure that was very cautiously laid out, because as David said wisely before, time is very crucial here. Times, the two times. And many of the scenes in the book are not accidental. They are time related. So therefore, many of the visions had to be here and not there for structural reasons.
It's interesting that, I wouldn't have, if you had asked me, how would you guess Ruby writes, right? At first I would have said, well, I'm not sure, let me think about it. And then I would have said, well, what you said has to be the case, because the book is, on one level, I think it's fair to say, about precision and what happens when precision collapses. Absolutely. Because the temple and the service in the temple is about precision, doing the precise ritual in precisely this way. And when Andrew's life is working, right, the parallel is, I mean, these wonderful descriptions you have of him preparing meals, which I could only, I'm sorry, imagine you doing the same thing. But I mean, in the way the meat, you know, meets the pan, I mean, some part of it we heard before, but there are other scenes which are far more exacting in it. And here, I'll come back to the review, actually. So, you know, the writing needed to be precise, it needed to be planned, because otherwise it couldn't embody the ritual which you exactly. then have to explore the collapse of.
Yes.
Right? And that's what happens here. Fair. It's about, right? That yes. Seder, that order, and the, right? And the collapse of the Seder. But having said that, I want to come back to what I read at the beginning from the Times book review, where it says, this is a book not to be recommended lightly. Right? So I want to agree with that and say that I recommend the book to you heavily. Right? And what I mean by that is that when you open this up, you will not quickly finish it, right? This will not take a weekend on the beach in Cape Cod, say. Right? It's going to take a lot longer than that. And it's for that very reason that I recommend heavily that you acquire a copy now. And this is not merely a sales job, though it's that as well. The reason I say that, though, is because one of the things that I learned from this book was from our experience. You described before the way Talmud can be a comment on our experience.
Yes.
Our experience can be a comment on Talmud. Commentary works in both directions
yes.
in this book. And if you want to understand the book of Leviticus and the service of the high priest, right, read about Andrew Cohn and the way he conducts himself with meat and with the savoring smell and so forth. Only that way will you genuinely understand the high priest in the temple on Yom Kippur. And I have to say, to appreciate our own experiences with details like this, you say, oh, the high priest was doing the same thing that I'm doing to a significant extent. And I understand myself better right? If I go back to the vision of the high priest as well. So you're not a Kohen, are you?
No, but I'm married to a Bat Kohen.
But you are married to a Bat Kohen. I'm going to remember, from this moment onward, I will forever think of you as a high priest.
Thank you, sir.
So thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let me end by saying that we've got a whole bunch of book talks coming up. I hope that we have your emails so that we can notify you them. I assume that if you're here, that for the most part, we do have your emails. The next one will be, I guess it's 2 weeks from now, February 14th, Wednesday, Adrian Levine, a scholar of Bible from Hebrew Union College downtown, who writes on biblical narratives of the Israelites and their neighbors, strangers at the gates. So the Bible on strangers, not just a little bit important in the world in which we find ourselves. There are others following that, and I'm excited to also to announce that we've recently added a new book talk for this year, another very important Hebrew author, Ayelet Gundar Goshen, who will be here on April 24th, discussing, I think we've worked out, both of her novels that have been translated into English, Waking Lions, and her earlier novel, One Night Markovitch. So look for our announcements. Thank you again for coming. Books are for sale outside, and the author will be happy to sign copies.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think Akash is going to be